Welcome, members and guests, to the May 9th program of the City Club of Eugene. Welcome, TV audiences on community television. I'm Mary Layton, City Club past president. Thank you to KLCC for airing the programs at 6:30 p.m. on Monday nights for our radio listening audience. Our sponsors today are Network Charter School, a standards-based, hands-on public school for students in grades 7 to 12, Eugene Legal, offering convenient, affordable legal services to people in the Eugene-Springfield area. KRVM, listener-supported public radio. And a special thank you to KPFF Consulting Engineers for our office space. We thank you for listening. These programs are free for our listening audiences, yet there are costs involved. Your contribution is completely tax-deductible and will help keep our organization healthy. Today's presenter is David K. Johnston, who will discuss the topic of how inequality affects you. The coordinator is Joel Corin, who will introduce our speaker.
Usually nobody applauses me, and I say thank you for your warm applause, but thank you for your warm applause. 99%, 1%. Income inequality is a major topic in today's society. The president spoke about it in the State of the Union, and today in Rome, Pope Francis spoke about it to the UN and the leaders of the UN various committees. Very few people know more or have written more about income inequality than David K. Johnston. And for his work, he received the Pulitzer Prize in early 2000s. David K. Johnston is brought here today by the Oregon Center of Public Policy. The Oregon Center of Public Policy is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, investigative group that looks into topics of public interest. In addition to David's book, The Divided, which is on sale outside today, the Oregon Center of Public Policy just finished another study on income inequality in Oregon, and that will be available outside today also for free. David K. Johnston is a newspaper man, has worked, I found out at lunch today, at my old stomping grounds, the Philadelphia area at the Philadelphia Inquirer, worked for the New York Times for many years, worked for the LA Times, and actually covered Oregon for the LA Times. He's currently a distinguished visiting professor and lecturer of law at the Syracuse University Law School, teaching an interesting course on tax from ancient times to today. And he is also the board president of Investigative Reporters and Editors. He's written extensively on the topic of income inequality. Most of his books are serious, and you know they're serious because each one of his books has a colon in the title. Like this one is Divided, colon, The Perils of Our Growing Income Inequality. It's a pleasure to present to you David K. Johnston.
Well, thank you for having me here today to speak. For the last 20 years, can you hear me all right back there? Okay. For the last 20 years of my life, I have been focused on inequality, which in the last few years, particularly since the Occupy movement, has been on the public agenda. When I started writing about inequality for the New York Times in 1995, the Times was flooded with complaints that I was this crazy person who had no idea what I was doing. And my position to the editors of the Times was that inequality in America is the product of government policy. That the reason that we are seeing the changes we are comes from government policy. So I want to start out by giving you a little bit of history. The courses I teach at Syracuse Law, and I'm not a lawyer, but I've taught there now for 6 years, are on the regulation of business and property and tax, and how the laws of the ancient world inform us about our laws and our policies today. For example, progressive taxation is the oldest surviving principle in Western civilization. It is older than the argument you will hear from some people today, the ahistorical and false argument that the Judeo-Christian tradition is marriages between one man and one woman, which anybody who's actually read their Bible knows is not the case. Progressive taxation is 2,500 years old, and it is based on the fundamental moral principle that in man's natural state in the jungle, there is no wealth creation, and whatever wealth you have can be taken by any thug who's big enough to take it away from you. But if you lived in Athens, with its laws that defined your property versus other people's property, its courts to adjudicate disputes, its military to protect you from the Phoenicians and others, the greater the fortune you managed to attain because you lived in Athens, the greater your moral duty to support Athens with your taxes, because it was the civilization of Athens that made your gains possible. An idea that we seem to have lost sight of. The founders of this country and the framers were intensely aware of this. Now remember, we live in the second American Republic. The first American Republic failed after 7 years because it had no power to tax and no power to regulate commerce. Well, John Adams, our second president, wrote that his greatest fear about the future of our country wasn't foreign enemies. It wasn't any of the things you might have probably imagined. It was that in the United States, a business aristocracy would arise. And this business aristocracy would see to it that everyone else was a wage earner. That instead of having yeoman farmers who owned their land, you would have people who worked the land for other people. Instead of craftsmen and workers who owned their own tools and worked for themselves, they would become wage employees. And Adams wrote that he feared this would lead to enormous inequality, and that inequality would lead to the majority of people being persuaded that what was good for them was what was good for the business aristocrats, and we would lose our liberties, and we would lose our democracy. In 1792, the United States Congress passed its first labor law, and its first federal subsidy. The cod fishing industry back then was responsible for a quarter of our foreign earnings, and the U.S. began in such deep debt that about 80% or more of the federal government's revenues were simply devoted to paying off the debt from the Revolutionary War and the First American Republic. The British Navy was harrying our cod fishing ships. Well, Thomas Jefferson, being a man of science, unlike a lot of people in Congress these days, said he wanted a study done, if we were going to give a subsidy, of how to make it work. And he then sponsored and Congress enacted and President Washington signed a law that said if you had a cod fishing ship and simply paid wages to the fishermen, you did not receive any benefit from the government. But if you paid wages plus a share of the profits to what were called sharesmen, and the sharesmen had a negotiated contract in advance of the ship leaving port, you could get this subsidy, 5/8 of which went to the sharesmen, the fishermen, and 3/8 of which went to the owners. Now, I don't know about you, but that sounds a lot to me like modern collective bargaining. And by the way, Adam Smith, if you read Adam Smith, and there's a chapter from Adam Smith in this book, very much believed we should pay people in teams. That is, you didn't do it alone, you did it as part of a team. What I have been documenting for years now are policies that get very, very little attention. I could sit any of you down with a computer today and show you enormous amounts of government statistics on benefits for the poor, the elderly, the disabled. I can slice and dice Social Security, for example, widows and orphans benefits, by how many years the person who died worked, what their average income was, what their gender was, what their race was. You can slice and dice those all day long. What I've had to dig out of the public record through years of hard work is the massive subsidies that go to Warren Buffett, that go to General Electric, that go to Deutsche Bank, that go to CIBI, the big communist bank based in Beijing. Here in Oregon, state law allows corporations which make a deal with the state, and only big corporations get these deals, to keep the state income taxes withheld from their workers' paychecks, and the workers don't know about it. And I'm curious, did any of you know about this? One person must have read some of my work on this. 20 states have these deals, almost 3,000 big corporations. Every big brand name company you've heard of, including many foreign companies like Nissan and Deutsche Bank, have these deals to keep the income taxes. And because the workers had the taxes withheld, the workers are unaware of it because they've paid their taxes. They just don't know that they went to their bosses instead of to the government. And of course, those taxes, therefore, do not go to pay for education. They don't go to pay for cops or firefighting or civil justice or fish biologists or any of the other things we need to make the modern world work. In fact, at the state and local level, on average, everyone in America is paying $225 per year in subsidies to corporations, a growing share of which go to retail. They go to shopping malls, big box retail stores like Home Depot and Walmart, to hotels, to other retail establishments which provide no economic growth because they are the end of the economic chain. But these favored businesses are running local businesses out because of the subsidies that they receive. And so that's why you're seeing the nationalization of commerce. So many small entrepreneurs, the local burger class in cities all across America, being decimated through government policy that picks the winners and losers and yet gets virtually no coverage anywhere in the news. Well, all of these policies together are what we examine and divided. In the years that I have been talking about this, people ask two questions. What do we do about it is one. This book is about what are all the other dimensions of this. There are 44 contributors who wrote chapters for this book. I'm just the editor of it, and then I wrote two of the chapters. So Elizabeth Warren, the champion of consumers against Wall Street, has a chapter in the book. President Obama has a chapter in the book. Joe Stiglitz and Paul Krugman have chapters in this book. People you probably have not heard of but are very highly respected in their fields, what MSNBC the other day referred to as all the heavy hitters, are in this book. And let me cite you one example. Dr. Stephen Bezrishka, who teaches health policy at the University of Washington and was an emergency room physician for 30 years, has a chapter called Inequality Kills. We have known since at least 1964 that, in fact, extreme inequality is bad for health. And there are innumerable studies that show this. And he points out that in the United States, yesterday and today and tomorrow and every single day, 47 newborn infants die who would live had they been born in Sweden or Norway. 45 or 46 die had they been who would have lived if they had been born in Japan. And while not in the book, I have written a piece about the book for another publication and pointed out that 15 children die every day in America who would live had they been born in Cuba. Think about that. Think about that the next time you get told by a politician, we're the greatest. We have the greatest health care in the world. We have the greatest system in the world. No, we don't. And in my travels around the world, particularly during the little over a year that I was the worldwide economics columnist for Reuters, one of the things that I learned was people in other places, in China and Singapore and Europe and Canada, well-educated people, some of them people who are experts in their fields, if you talk to them long enough, they would just begin laughing about how stupid Americans are in our policies and how we were destroying our economy here in America. Now, one of the chapters in this book early on goes to an issue that you've all heard in the news in recent years. We don't have poor people in America because everybody has a refrigerator. You may remember 20 years ago, Newt Gingrich made a similar argument when he said, we don't have poor people, everybody has a color TV. So one of the chapters, a very brief one in the book, is called Necessaries, and it comes from Adam Smith, who figured out market economics, and who pointed out that no one needs a linen shirt. But in 18th century England, if you did not have a linen shirt, no one would give you a job in any decent work area. He talks about how in France it was perfectly socially acceptable for women to go shoeless. But in England, if a woman didn't have shoes, this was a mark of something's wrong with this family. We have what are cultural necessities to be part of society. Well, we live in a society now where inequality, largely through government policies that subtly take from the many and give to the few, are making enormous consequences. I wrote a trilogy before this book for a big publisher. I did this for a little nonprofit publisher for a magazine fee, basically. My agent thinks that I'm crazy to have done this book at all. The trilogy that I did, Perfectly Legal, which is about taxes, Free Lunch, which is about subsidies, and The Fine Print, which is about restraint of trade, details all sorts of policies virtually nobody knows about that take money out of your pocket and redistribute it. And I'll give you one simple, quick example. Every time you put gasoline in your car, there's an embedded cost for the pipeline that brought either the oil or the natural gas to you. The industry that runs the pipelines gets to collect, as a regulated monopoly, the taxes it has to pay, because as a monopoly, it has to cover those taxes. Well, it also gets actually what's called the grossed-up tax. So if the corporate tax rate's 35% plus state taxes, they get about 60% above their profit. They get their profit, let's say $1 billion, and then $600 million more to pay the taxes. Well, all well and good, except for one little fact. Since 1987, the pipeline industry has been exempt from the corporate income tax. They just get a 60% bump up of their already rich profits. And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of devices like this in my weekly column in Al Jazeera, in my articles almost every week in Newsweek, and my columns a couple times a month for tax analysts and National Memo. I keep finding and exposing more and more of these. So let me give you a couple of income numbers to understand why you should care about this, why a less equal society would make things better for you. Because when people don't have adequate incomes, many of them end up becoming tax eaters rather than tax payers. You are forced in one way or another to support them, particularly those who become disabled and cannot work, prematurely disabled and cannot work. Since 1998, the median wage in this country, half make more, half make less, has been stuck at a little over $500 a week. It has not gone up. The average income of the bottom 90% of Americans, and the threshold to get out of the 90% right now is a little over $100,000 a year, but the average is only $30,000. In 2012, the average fell below the level of 1966. In 1966, I was in high school. Last December, I applied for Medicare. So let me go back to 2011, because the income, average income, was a little higher than in 1966. It was $59 higher per household. Not that anybody would notice $5 a month more pre-tax income. Well, let's imagine that $59 as 1 inch. So 280 million Americans ended up after 45 years in 2011 with an increase, if we were doing a graphic in the newspaper or magazine or on TV, 1 inch high. So how'd the 1% do? The 1% starts at about $360,000, 12 times the average. Because my wife is an executive and I work like a dog, we're in the 1%. Half of the 1%, by the way, are between $360,000 and half a million. Well, their line would come up from the floor here. It would go above my head. It would go through the ceiling. It would go up over 160 feet. But that's actually misleading. The top tenth of 1%, that's less than 320,000 Americans. Those 320,000 Americans start at about $2 million a year, and their total income as a group, one in a thousand, is almost as much as the bottom half of all Americans. Their line, over 880 feet. But that's still misleading as to where the income growth is taking place. There's one more group, well, there's actually two more groups, one more for this purpose, and that's the 1% of the 1%, the 16,000 best-off households in America. This is a group that Mitt Romney is near the bottom of. That group starts at about $10 million. And how have they done since 1966 to this 1 inch? 5 miles. When the Great Depression officially ended in 1933, the best year in the history of the stock market, by the way, 1933, to 1934, the average income of the bottom 90% of Americans went up in 1934, almost 9%. The 1% of the 1%, their income went down a little bit. So what happened in the Great Recession, which officially ended in the middle of 2009? Well, from 2009 to 2012, the most recent data we have, a third of all the increased income in this entire country went to those 16,000 households. 95 cents of every dollar of increased income went to the 1%. 121% of the increased income went to the top 10%. How can that be? Because the 90% have a smaller piece of pie. In fact, the average income of the bottom 90% was at $36,000 in 2000, when people were persuaded that what we really needed to do was change policy and go to the tax cuts proposed by George W. Bush. I called his campaign in the fall of 2000 when I was at the New York Times, and they were running ads saying, we're into a recession, the Clinton-Gore recession, and said, well, you know, you guys are saying everybody will be better off if you're elected and your tax cuts are enacted. You think maybe you want to hedge your bets, given your own advertising? This was taken as a hostile question. I was immediately asked, who is your editor? And gave him the number of the executive editor of the New York Times and said, are you sure you don't want to hedge your bets? And they went, absolutely not. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. Incomes will rise. We will all be better off as a group if we do this. And then I was asked, when's your story going to run? And I said, oh, in about 10 years. The guy goes, 10 years? And I said, well, yeah, in 10 years we'll have the data, and I'll go back and I'll check this. Well, 10 years later, if you adjust for inflation and the population of the country, we were behind by $3.7 trillion. It didn't work. But what has worked is all of the policies that we talk about in this book involving health, health care, family structure, family leave for parents with small children, which is, by the way, mandatory in some European countries where it's a crime to try and work if you have a small child. Debt and poverty, the return of debtors' prisons in America. We have thousands and thousands of people being arrested for debts in America now, something that we were supposed to have stopped in the year 1801. We have the rise of large numbers of people who have no stable source of income. And through this, and oh, and one more thing, there's a wonderful chapter in here called The Georgia Hunger Games. It is about how the state of Georgia decided that we really shouldn't have food stamps. I want to get rid of food stamps. I think they're a terrible thing to have, but I want to get rid of them because we don't need them. Georgia decided to follow the policy of don't feed the animals, they'll breed. And so hungry children were denied food by the state of Georgia, and hence our name, the Georgia Hunger Games. We are creating a society that is exactly what our founders worried about. We are creating a society whose economic policy is to take from the many and very, very quietly take from the many and redistribute to the few. None of this is to suggest we shouldn't have business and we shouldn't have markets. My whole career has been devoted to, at least my whole career in the last 20 years, to competitive markets and integrity in business. But that's not what we're seeing. We have banks that have committed numerous well-documented felonies, but no prosecutions. We have hedge funds that use borrowed money in ways that threaten to bring the economy down again to speculate in the markets. We want to have speculators, we just don't want to have speculators running the markets. We have among modern countries the highest rate by far of child poverty, and that's a terribly expensive thing to have. Because it means that we're choosing in the future not to be as well off by not nurturing and educating children as well as we can. We are consuming our public furniture, our infrastructure. I literally was on a radio show with a congressman who said, you know, well, I don't know where you get the idea. We can afford to fix this. We can't, we have no money to do this. We cannot fix our roads. And I said, so what are you proposing, Congressman? We just shut down the national economy? Nobody can buy oranges anymore if they don't live on a ranch that grows oranges? He said, well, I don't know, but we can't afford to do this. The fundamental policy that we're pursuing in this country is to protect the already rich from market forces and from new economic growth. We're also pursuing a policy that you can hear very clearly by the Republicans, and I'm a registered Republican, by the way. The Republicans I will give credit to for something the Democrats can't seem to do. The Democrats can't figure out what to do about the economy. But the Republicans have articulated what they believe to be our major economic problem, and they have a solution. And if you listen carefully to people like Paul Ryan and say, what is he saying, you'll see the following. The problem is the rich don't have nearly enough. The rich will not invest, they won't create jobs, because they don't have enough. And the solution to get them more money is to cut taxes, and therefore to cut money spent on the sick, the elderly, the disabled, and most significantly of all, children. That's what they're proposing. All you need to do is read the Paul Ryan budget, and you'll see that. Now, we can choose to do this. We chose the inequality we have. We chose to no longer be in the economic distribution zone of Western Europe, Canada, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, like we used to be, and to instead have as our economic neighbors Brazil, China, Mexico, Russia, and Venezuela. And if you want to live in those countries, then you should re-elect the politicians we have and support them, because that's where we're going, to be an oligarchy. I hope all of you will read this book. You can also get it in Kindle. And after you read it, tell other people about it, because if we do not understand what inequality is doing to us, how it is affecting all of us, even those of us who are doing just fine economically, then we will get more and more of these policies, because the very wealthy in America employ more than 100,000 people whose job is to figure out how to get government policies put in place, policies you are never going to hear about because they're too detailed and too subtle, and there's too many of them for me to ever write about, that subtly take from you to give to them. Thank you.
And now it's time for us to break, so people at tables can get some questions together for our distinguished speaker. Thank you, David K. Johnson.
You're tuned to KLCC Eugene 89.7 FM, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. We're also on the web at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the City Club program. How Inequality Affects You, on May 9th. Our guest speaker is David K. Johnston, and we will now hear from members with their questions.
That's right.
Hi, Bob.
Thank you, David. Bob Cassidy, City Club member. I'm told that the proposed minimum wage law of $10 would directly affect 30 million people, directly or indirectly. It would increase the total wages paid by $34 billion. This is FICA taxes paid for by the employer and the employee. That money all goes to Social Security and Medicare. Why is it that the economists and AARP and people like this are not talking about that kind of thing?
Okay. The proposal to restore the minimum wage You're talking about $10 or $11 it's to restore it. I was a minimum wage worker in 1966. I was married. I had the first of my eight children, and I went to high school, and I worked 80 hours a week. And my overwhelming memory of that year is, need to sleep. I cannot imagine today, Bob, how we would have made it. I would have put food on the table and rented our crummy little apartment, and I often would go to work with literally not a dime in my pocket. So if I got a flat tire, I don't know what I would have done. So I think it's important that we set a standard and that we raise the minimum wage, and there are a lot of studies showing where there are matched counties that raising the minimum wage, I mean, think about it, if suddenly the minimum wage was raised here, but not in, the nearest town is Springfield or Albany? Springfield. Yeah, Albany is by Corvallis. Springfield. Are you going to drive over to Springfield because dinner will be a dollar cheaper? People just don't do that as a practical matter, and it doesn't lead to fewer jobs. The FICA taxes will apply, but for most minimum wage workers, because of Ronald Reagan's earned income tax credit, they'll get that rebated to them. That's why you're not hearing a lot of noise about the Social Security and Medicare tax. It's because it'll be rebated. The half that comes out of workers' paychecks will be rebated. And the other half, the employer half, is actually wages the workers earn, and government simply taxes away at a rate of 100%. It's not an employer contribution. It's just disguised in what it is. But the reason you're not hearing a lot about the FICA tax on it is it will mostly be returned to people. And a little fact to keep in mind about this, the bottom third of American workers, that's a little over 50 million workers, make less than $15,000 a year. It's less than $280 a week, and their average earnings are $6,000 each, which tells you that a lot of them are part-time, but not all of them. There's at least 10 million and probably more on the order of 15, 16 million of those workers who are full-time workers. So, okay?
Susan Conley, Club Meeting. Hi, thank you so much for joining us. My question is, can you give us your opinion on how well or how successfully President Obama has talked about this growing inequality and also the corporate welfare?
Sure. President Obama has done a terrific job of explaining inequality. The chapter in the book from him is a slightly edited copy of the speech he gave at a high school in Kansas City, the same high school where President Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, gave his inequality speech 100 years earlier. And in explaining the broad issues of this, and I know he's read at least one of my books, he does a very good job of that. I mean, I would fault him. He's been dealt a very bad card with Congress, but I would fault him on some other things. I mean, there's just no excuse for not prosecuting senior bankers who were involved in bringing down the economy. There is no excuse for him refusing to meet, or anyone in his administration or on Capitol Hill, to meet with Bill Black. I wrote about him recently in Newsweek. He was the regulator who got 3,000 felony convictions in the savings and loan scandal. And 1,000 of those high-level insiders and 800 of those 1,000 got prison. And no one will talk to Bill Black in Washington. He's far too cozy with Wall Street. Glenn Beck, notwithstanding, he has surrounded himself with overwhelmingly a white staff and overwhelmingly a staff up until the appointment of Janet Yellen, which I was among the people who said this would be a terrible mistake to put Larry Summers in charge of the Federal Reserve. A terrible job on that. But in terms of getting people to understand inequality, starting with his Joe the Plumber meeting during the campaign in 2008. And by the way, you can go on the YouTube and see the whole 7 minutes. And what President Obama says in those 7 minutes, then candidate Obama, is almost word for word out of my book, Free Lunch, about why Joe the Plumber would actually be better off under Obama tax policies and how he would be able to start a business sooner and accumulate more wealth. And clearly, we know since then Joe the Plumber has zero interest in learning any facts that would alter his fixed view of the world. So, okay?
Okay, this is John Anik, City Club member since 2002. Now, question, what can we do in the next election to implement change in the direction of our economic policy?
There are two simple things to do. Get people to the polls. The reason Scott Walker was not recalled in Wisconsin, you know, where people who were with him came up with a new description for public school teachers, specifically kindergarten teachers, thugs. So they were calling him. If you go back and look at the material at the state capitol. And he did not speak out and say it's not appropriate to call teachers thugs. But the reason he didn't get recalled was that the Koch brothers didn't just put money into media, as the progressives and the unions did. They also put money into driving people to the polls, to calling people up and saying, can we offer you a ride to go vote? If you don't vote, it doesn't matter. And so the number one overwhelming thing to do is get people to the polls. The second thing to do is make sure that your state legislature, when the 2020 census data comes out, doesn't gerrymander districts. In Pennsylvania, more than half the votes go to Democrats for Congress, but 75% of the congressional delegation is Republican. In the 2012 elections, the Democrats got 1.4 million more votes nationwide than the Republicans, but they're the minority party because of gerrymandering. So focus less, I think, on presidential elections and much more on state legislatures and on getting people to the polls.
Jerry Smith, City Club member since 2003. Hi. Are there some at the top who can help with needed changes? I.e., just one example, stop burning fossil fuel and give us new renewable industries by investing in America?
Okay. Well, first of all, remember that wealthy people are like everybody else. There's a whole wide range of views among wealthy people. Many of the best sources I've had who've drawn to my attention these policies that redistribute are very wealthy people. And they've been instrumental to the success of my work. And I've actually thanked a couple of quarter billionaires who are friends of mine in Rochester for their contributions to my understanding of these issues, because they compete against really big companies, these guys, and they see the big companies getting rules that make it hard for them, wealthy as they are. You know, we're seeing a drop in demand for electricity in this country. Electricity demand is falling. The development of LED light bulbs and CFL light bulbs, the reason they have that big base on them, you see, is because they have to convert AC power back to DC to work. But if we were to redo our energy system over, the next 50 years, we could radically reduce our use on fossil fuels. We could have electric cars that are charged during the night when there's very little demand, particularly in places like here where there's lots of hydro and wind power. If we were willing to change our notion of what houses should look like and put both photovoltaic cells and hot water heating systems on roofs, we could radically reduce our use of electricity and our use of fossil fuels. The problem is that the biggest sunk cost, that is already invested, not recoverable cost in the world, is the fossil fuel industries. And the investors in those industries are not going to just easily give up on it. And ExxonMobil, which is, by the way, one of the best managed companies in the world, they are never going to be a green company. You know, General Motors is never going to be a green company. That's not the business they're in. Companies don't change. The New York Times at one time owned the worldwide exclusive rights to a 150-year-old technology called fax machines. And they could not figure out how to make money off of it because they're in the newspaper business. So to change that, I think we need a very simple way to reduce fossil fuel consumption. Wall Street wants something called cap and trade, create markets where people trade emissions. It's a terrible thing to do, and it just makes money for Wall Street. You want to reduce carbon? Just tax the hell out of it.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Milne. Hi. Our table was talking about the trickle-down theory, and we have a local example, we think, in a group of business people who want to build in an area between Eugene and Springfield. It's called Glenwood, and they'll put a hotel and conference center there, but they want City of Springfield and our county government
to pay for
part of it. Yeah. So what is your response when people say that business creates jobs and wealth for everyone else, and that's why they should have subsidies?
Okay. Well, businesses create wealth. Corporations are very important. We want to have corporations. The proto-corporations began with the Romans. But in America, in British colonial America, and I've had my research assistants at the law school spend the last 2.5 years working on this, you know how many corporations were created in America at the time of the signing of the Declaration of Independence? There had been 7. 6 of them, including the Boston Water Works, we would call today either public utilities or charities. Exactly 1 in the colony of New Haven, later Connecticut, was created solely for the purpose of making profit. And within a year, it had to be shut down because it was such an enormous scandal, and it took about 10 years to clean up the mess. So the founders and the framers were very skeptical of corporations, even though they're very important to minimize risk and get people to invest. But why do corporations need subsidies? And a hotel? That's the end of the retail chain. All you're doing when you have the government finance a new hotel is take business away from another hotel unless you're a growing market. And if you're a growing market, then the market will provide. And the simple way to think about these subsidies is this. If it's a sound investment, the market will finance it. If it is not a sound investment, why should you be forced as a taxpayer to invest in it for zero return? And just one other example of this. Boeing this year arranged to get $13 billion of subsidies to move to South Carolina where it would be able to have a non-union workforce. Alcoa, which has operations all around the world, I think there are about 30 countries where they have smelters, in just New York State, Alcoa is getting a subsidy that if they take all of it, they say they're not going to take all of it, but if they do, is worth $5.6 billion. That is all the at the average rate of profits for the last 3 years that they turned a profit. That is 18 years of the worldwide profits of Alcoa. Well, they have a deal like this in every country they operate in. Alcoa is one of many, many companies, and in free lunch I name a bunch of them in the industries, that don't make any money in the market. They only make money from the taxpayers. And so one of the reasons we don't have money to invest in children and to fix the roads and invest in basic research is we're taking care of these companies that don't earn their own way and are on the dole. They're the real welfare recipients. So.
Stu Thomas, City Club member.
Hi, Stu.
Hi. Our curiosity at our table was piqued by one of your initial statements that, just to name a company by example, Nike, for example, collects state income tax from...
I don't know that Nike actually has that deal. There are companies that in Oregon that have that deal.
Okay. Oh, well, that's...
I was citing them as an example of a big company actually for international tax policy.
I see. Well, that we weren't clear on. But exactly, our question is exactly how is this done? Do they hold on to the money, invest it, collect the interest, and pass it on to the government at the end of the year?
No.
And is there a name for the bill, and when was it passed?
Sure. The Oregon law took effect, I believe, in 2012, but it may have been 2013. It's one of the later states to do this. And it's very simple. The workers have the taxes withheld from their paycheck, and they see that. And the company then files with its state tax return a tax credit form that allows it to keep the money. Now, Oregon is different than the other 19 states in one regard. It is treated technically as a loan, a forgivable loan. So if the company that got the deal said, we will build this factory or we will employ 100 additional people, and after so many years they haven't done it, the state can go back and say, give us the money back, no interest. But as a practical matter, there are almost none of these clawbacks. But the reason you don't see it is the corporate tax return in most states is confidential. Wisconsin's one of the few where it isn't. And the company simply uses it as an offset. And most of the state laws are written in a way that imagine a union got together and said, well, okay, we got a bargaining tactic here. We're going to change our withholding forms so no state taxes withheld from our checks. Well, since the state knows everybody who works there, they just go through everybody's state tax return, add up the state taxes they owed from that employment, and then give the company a tax credit equal to that amount of money. So writing the check directly to the state doesn't save you from the problem. And the only company that I know of that's disclosed that it did this is GE in a deal in Ohio where they're getting 92% of the cost of modernizing a factory from the taxpayers, and GE earns about a 10% annual return on its equity, which means they will make a more than 100% annual return on their actual investment in this plant. And you think how well off you'd be if the government built your factory for you.
Hello. Kerry Thompson, City Club member.
Hi, Kerry.
We're just thinking, you know, how can this redistribution upward that's going on, how can that be reversed?
How do we reverse the upward redistribution? You know, none of these things get solved in a hurry. When I was in sixth grade in Santa Cruz, California, I gave a talk about how by the time I was my parents' age, in my 50s, racism would be history. It took us 33 years to dig ourselves into this hole. We didn't have these kinds of subsidies until about the beginning of the age of Reagan. We had some subsidies. They were around. But they've really taken off since about the mid-90s. And both the Democrats and Republicans are deeply involved in doing this. And the way you change it is people have to say to politicians, I'm not going to vote for you. People need to see people voted out of office over this or recalled. And people need to show up at city council. When I started out as a reporter, I would expose deals that in today's dollars are maybe $250,000. And I'd go down to the next city council meeting, and the room would be packed with ordinary homeowners saying, what the? And demanding that something be done. I have written about numerous multi-billion dollar scandals in recent years, a few of which have resulted in change. The Oregon legislature passed a law because of my work that Warren Buffett later got repealed after 8 years. But many of them, nothing happens. And why? It's because voters don't feel powerful. They don't get organized. They don't, you know, go and mow their congressperson or their senator and say, you know, we're going to vote you out if you don't fix this or stop this. So it's going to take time and organization.
Thank you for your work.
Thank you,
Corey. Michael Kerrigan, a member of City Club. How can we address the myth that corporate taxes are so much higher here than in other countries?
Well, it's been addressed a lot. I mean, I can't tell you how many front page stories I've wrote, and since I left 6 years ago, other people have written about it. I think it's important to raise the underlying question, should we tax corporations? I have, for a long time, said Congress should conduct a thorough study, should spend money to hire people, academics and tax economists and others, to study whether we should continue to tax corporations or whether there's a different way to do this. But what happens now is multinational companies profit off the tax system. And the short explanation of how that works is you siphon money out of the country through accounting devices offshore. You then take that money and you buy the debt that Congress had the federal government sell because it didn't get your taxes. So if you have $1 billion, 4% interest, 3% inflation, you go forward 30 years. Remember, we may not be here in 30 years, but the corporations expect to still be here in 30 years. The corporation now has gotten $2.4 billion of compound interest. If it pays the bill at that point, the taxes we collect are only worth, after inflation, $400 million. And the remaining $2.4 billion the company has, adjusted for inflation, is worth $1 billion. So it didn't cost them anything. They actually made money off the tax system. And the corporations want high rates. The whole trick is to earn profits in a high-rate jurisdiction and move the money to a low-rate jurisdiction. It's called stateless income. So this is one of a lot of things where things are not as they appear on the surface, and rates, posted rates, are insignificantly important. What matters are the rules on when you pay and when you are recognized as having earned the income that will be taxed.
My name is Ruth Miller, and I've been a member since 1990. But our question,
so the club has been here since at least 1990.
Yeah. All right. It has. Our question from our table is, if we don't change our direction, what do you specifically expect to happen? Are we on our way to becoming a Brazil or China?
Um, if we don't change where, well, Thomas Piketty in his book, Capital in the 21st Century, which is the number one bestseller, says that, you know, everything we're seeing must continue. And I've said under current policies it must continue. Where Thomas and I disagree is I don't believe the trend can continue forever. And eventually one of two things will happen. We either will become like Brazil, we will have a huge number of people who are very poor, and we will have all the dangers that go with that, or we'll be more like 18th century France. And if we ever have a revolution in this country, it will be the bloodiest thing the world has ever seen by far. It will be really vicious. I was doing a radio interview maybe 10 years ago in the living room of my home, and my two youngest daughters, who are now 24 and 28, were listening, and they started smirking. And I kept thinking, what are they smirking about? And when I got off the radio, I said, what's so funny? And they said, Dad, did you get asked if you'd get shot if there was a revolution? And I said, yeah. And they both erupted in laughter, and I said, well, what's so funny? And they said, well, you know, Dad, you say because you have eight kids you're an incurable optimist. If you think you get shot in the second round, Dad, you're even more optimistic than we imagined. But, I mean, I literally worry about that, that we will devolve, and some demagogue will come along and exploit this, and we will end up, I mean, think about all the people walking around now and getting laws passed so they can carry guns, the incidents that have happened in parks where parents have called and said, there are all these men with guns in the park, and they call the police, and in their state, the police come and say, well, they're not breaking the law. They can walk around with these automatic machine guns and semi-machine guns and handguns and rifles and shotguns, and it's perfectly legal. You can go into bars now with guns. I don't know about you. Somebody walks into a bar with a gun, I'm leaving. And so we've had members of Congress for both Presidents Clinton and Obama ask why somebody hasn't killed them. And one said of Clinton, you know, if he comes down here, he better not, somebody's going to kill him. I mean, this is very bad stuff that we have going on, and it's a real problem. So I'm very concerned that we will end up with a revolution if we don't fix this. I want us to fix this by peaceful means that are consistent with our Constitution and with long-standing principles that go back as far as 2,500 years.
Randy Prince, City Club member.
Hi, Randy.
Our table was struck by several things you said, but the one that really stood out is, why are you a registered Republican? You then followed with some description of why leading Republicans are doing terrible things, even though you earlier did say that you believe in markets and competition.
Right.
The bigger question that really comes to is the one that was asked earlier. It's like the solutions. When you've got the president of the other party reading your book, and we've still got what we have,
right,
and you've got Republicans acting in a way that obviously you don't like, what really might accomplish something?
Okay.
Can you give us some examples of successful efforts?
First of all, I used to be in the Independence Party. In New York, we have four or five political parties. And then one day, Loretta Filani, former Communist Party candidate for President of the United States, her supporters called and asked if I'd support her for Lieutenant Governor, and that's when I walked out of the Independence Party. But I'm a registered Republican because where I live, there's no point in being a registered Democrat. There's nothing interesting. And furthermore, Teddy Roosevelt was a registered Republican, and Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. And what do we hear every day? Republicans are the party of the big tent. So is it big enough to take in me? And I'm a founder of a business with 25 workers, co-founder. So on the other question about solutions, the real underlying, there are a couple of underlying fundamental solutions. If you have not read the Lewis Powell memo, go to the internet, go to Google, put in Powell memo. Lewis Powell, who became a Supreme Court justice, wrote this memo in response to the absolute terror that Ralph Nader struck into the hearts of corporate America. And you will see that he talks about, in order for business to dominate the country, we need to bring the press to heel, we need to develop our own means of communication, we need to have our own means to develop information to sell to people, or promote to people. We need to get rid of the unions and other steps, all of which have transpired. And what are the solutions to change this? Well, number one, if you believe in market economics, you should believe in unions. We need to get back unions. All of our economic competitors have unions. And if anybody says to you, unions are not American, General Douglas MacArthur, as we all know, one of the great lefties of history, As Pro-Council of Japan required Japan to put in its constitution unions, very strong unions. Japan is very highly unionized because he had a three-part strategy for Japan after the war. Decentralize, democratize, get rid of the hierarchy. Equalize. So if we had unions, we would have a much stronger counterweight. And then underneath all, that's the campaign finance system. You know, as long as dollars are speech, the rich get more votes. You know, there's a wonderful Jeff Danziger cartoon that shows a huddled family under a bridge and a limousine and Chief Justice Roberts standing there saying, I just want you to know on my way home that the Supreme Court today has ensured your right to give as much money as you want to as many politicians as possible. Hi there.
Hi, John DeLoe, City Club member.
Hi, John.
It's Piketty, not Piketty, or?
You know, I don't know. The French say okay. Lacaire, I say Cairo.
Okay.
In Cairo, people say Cairo. I can't even say it the way they say it. So I've always said Piketty. It's what I call a red word.
All right.
I think he says Piketty.
Piketty. Oh. Three of them. Enlighten us as to what the wealthy paid for taxes back when Eisenhower was
sure.
president. And can you expound a little more on Piketty's theories on...
Yeah. Under President Eisenhower, the top marginal tax rate in this country was 91%. It only applied to investment income, by the way, not to wages. The top on earned income is around 70%. The effect of this was two things. Number one, it basically put a maximum income on what you could spend on your lifestyle. So people were always trying to live off their expense accounts and things like that back then who were very wealthy. But the effect of the then 50% and higher corporate tax rates is, at the end of the year, if you're a small business owner, you try to run your business to actually show no profit. But when your tax rate is very high, you will reinvest in the business because the government picks up part of the cost. If it's a 50% tax rate and you decide to spend $100 million of profits to buy new trucks or to rebuild widget line number 4, the government's paying $50 million of the cost. And when you put capital into a business, you are creating jobs. When the tax rate's low, you withdraw capital, you get a higher lifestyle, which is exactly what Ronald Reagan said in 1980, just not in those terms, that he wanted the wealth owners, the wealth holders, to be able to enjoy the fruits of their enterprise. And so when you have a low tax rate, you go, oh, well, we'll pull money out of the business. And when you do that, you're destroying jobs. I'm not in favor of going back necessarily to those tax rates, but I think we can have lots of rules that encourage reinvestment in businesses and reinvestment here rather than abroad, because the agreements we have are not free trade agreements. They are managed trade agreements that are designed to promote labor arbitrage. Get rid of workers in America who cost you all in $40 an hour and replace them with workers in China who, even with transportation costs, cost you maybe $4 an hour, perhaps in some skilled areas $10 an hour. That's an enormous reduction in your costs. Piketty's basic argument is a simple algebra formula. R is greater than G. If the economy is growing at 1% and the return to capital for investment is 5%, capitalists will be better and better off and richer and richer. And so this is essentially what I've been saying in my writings for years. I was thrilled that he confirmed my view of the world. The problem is capital is so narrowly owned. We don't have to have narrowly owned capital. The financier Louis Kelso tried to get an economy where everyone is a capitalist. As I mentioned in the beginning of my talk, the founders basically wanted everyone to be a yeoman farmer or a worker who owned their own tools, make us all mini capitalists. And James Madison, before he died, wrote about how if everybody owned shares of business, we couldn't have everybody be a yeoman farmer because there just wasn't going to be enough land to do that. But if everybody owned shares of business, significant shares of business, then everybody could have a substantial income that wasn't dependent on their wages. So, I think that Piketty's only real flaw is his belief that the current trend will just continue forever, and it can't. So,
thank you. Thank you, David K. Johnson, for bringing clarity and vision.
And thanks again to our sponsors, Network Charter School, Eugene Legal, and KRVM. We meet again next Friday, May 16th, at the Downtown Athletic Club to hear update on the Lane Metro Partnership. Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting the office. Again, thank you, David.